As I read the Warren volumes, I continued to find discrepancies again and again and again and again and again. I don't care whether it's Paul McBride saying he was with Oswald in 1958 in New Orleans when Oswald was in Japan in the military, whether it's Alan Feld, who said he was with Oswald in Memphis, Tennessee, when Oswald was supposed to be on a ship to Japan. You know, it goes on and on and on and on and on. The obvious things that are known, Oswald at a shooting range when Oswald's supposed to be with his wife in Irving, Texas, Oswald buying a car when he's supposed to be at another location. So this is preceding the assassination. My point is that there are so many of these discrepancies that you become intrigued, and then your mind, at least my mind, turned to the point where I was looking for discrepancies. And there are lots of them. One thing leads to another.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. As I mentioned last week, since I started this podcast, I've received hundreds of emails asking about the events on the day of the assassination and afterwards that lead me to believe that there was a conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. People want to know the absolutes I stand by regarding the Kennedy assassination. Those key points that, in my view, prove a conspiracy, or at least suggest that things were not as they seemed to be, or as we were told they were. Today, we continue our new mini-series, The JFK Assassination, Hills to Die On. A hill to die on refers to a cause, belief, or position someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important that they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. Over the next several episodes, I'll be covering what I consider the crucial points, the hills to die on, when it comes to the Kennedy assassination.
Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
One of the biggest hills that I choose to die on in this case is the fact that we know with 110% certainty that there was someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks or possibly months leading up to the assassination. One of the strangest occurrences before and after the assassination was the sightings of other Oswalds. For months leading up to the assassination, there was a man or men seen around the Dallas area that was almost an exact double of the real Lee Harvey Oswald. There are literally dozens of these accounts in the record. These instances went on up to November 22nd. Some made an obvious scene, perhaps to be remembered afterwards. I'm going to be very transparent with you here. For years, I didn't believe the two Oswald theory, despite my fellow researchers like Penn Jones Jr., Jim Mars, Robert Groden, Larry Harris, and others telling me otherwise. It wasn't until the late 90s when I took a break from other research in this case and clearly focused on the double Oswalds in and around the Dallas area leading up to the assassination. I met with witnesses, dug through testimonies, spoke with other researchers, and after many months of focusing on the two Oswald theory, I came away more convinced about this happening than almost any other thing in this case. There is not a single doubt in my mind that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and setting up a narrative for him for some time before the assassination. So even if you don't believe some of these sightings, many of which were confirmed by multiple witnesses, so it's hard to discard those. It is very clear that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald. The question I have is why, and who was doing this? I can understand that a witness could say that they saw someone who merely resembled Oswald, especially when it's known that Oswald was elsewhere at the time. But that's not the case with these impersonations we're discussing here. In most instances, witnesses reporting that the man they identified as Lee Harvey Oswald provided specific details that made it clear he wanted people to believe he was Oswald, even if he wasn't the real Lee Harvey Oswald. This individual was essentially creating a narrative for Oswald, ensuring that after the assassination, people in and around Dallas would remember a loud-mouthed, arrogant, and angry man claiming to be Oswald and expressing anti-Kennedy sentiments. Please understand, all these instances that I'm going to name, we know the real Lee Harvey Oswald was at other places, such as the Ruth Payne home or at work. Just to name a few, the second Oswald was seen and spoken to by gunrunners Robert McEwen and Sam Neill in St. Leon, Texas in late August. The real Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans at this time. He did not return from New Orleans until late September. On Saturday, September 28th, with Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City, someone later identified as Oswald arrived after dark at the Sportsdrome Rifle Range in Dallas, Texas, for the first of numerous sightings that would be reported of Oswald at the rifle range. On this occasion, Oswald was said to have been driving a 1940 or 1941 Model Ford. He asked Malcolm H. Price Jr., a friend of the owner of the facility, to help him sight in his rifle. On this day, the real Lee Harvey Oswald was at the Payne home visiting his wife and children. About a week later, on October 3, 1963, a man resembling Lee Harvey Oswald was seen at the KOPY radio station in Alice, Texas, approximately 400 miles south of Dallas. He asked station manager Mike Rio about a job as a radio announcer. Several employees at the radio station said the man was identical to Oswald. The man claiming to be Oswald said he was unemployed and had just returned from Mexico. He was driving a Chevy sedan with his wife and a small child in the car. He mentioned that his wife did not speak any English. It's important to note that the real Lee Harvey Oswald did not own a car, did not have a driver's license, and there is no evidence that he ever drove a car. In an interview I did with Marina in the late 90s, she stated that she never knew of Lee Oswald driving a car. He relied on public transportation or hitchhiked rides because he couldn't drive. Additionally, on the evening of October 3, 1963, a waitress at the BF Cafe in Freer, Texas, about 30 minutes west of Alice, reported seeing a man who looked like Oswald eating at the cafe. The waitress said the man looked identical to Oswald, and he was accompanied by a woman and a small child. She mentioned that the woman spoke a foreign language. On October 4th, a man who identified himself as Oswald filled out a job application at the Hill Machinery Company in Alice, Texas. He listed his Marine Corps service on the application. Mechanics Leo Savulva and M.E. Pope later informed the FBI after the assassination that this man was identical to Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President Kennedy. Just like the earlier sightings, supposedly of Lee Harvey Oswald, we know these sightings in early October near Alice, Texas could not have been the real Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald met with the Texas Employment Commission on October 3rd and stayed overnight at the YMCA in Dallas. He could not have been in Alice, Texas. On October 4th, he hitchhiked from Dallas YMCA to Ruth Payne's home. You may say, well, maybe someone just looked similar to Oswald and these people thought it was him, but it wasn't. That can't be the case either here. Besides looking like Oswald, the individual demonstrated specific details about Oswald's life, indicating he was being deliberately impersonated. The witnesses say he said he had recently returned from Mexico, had a 2 to 3 year old daughter, and a foreign speaking wife. The man also used the name Oswald at the machinery company on his application. At the Texas Employment Commission, the real Lee Harvey Oswald met with and was interviewed by Laura Cottrell 3 different times. They had met for 3 to 4 hours total, so she kind of got to know him pretty well. Then, on October 17th, while Oswald was working at the Texas School Book Depository, a man came in to the Texas Employment Commission claiming to be Lee Harvey Oswald. Cottrell said that this man was not the real Lee Harvey Oswald, but wanted her to think he was for some reason. Cottrell concluded that this man was a fellow who was pretending to be the man whose wife had just had a baby and who had been coached on how to answer certain questions which might arise, and who forgets a little later how he answered them, or if he has. She added, quote, "In the course of the interview, I was struck with the thought that this man was not the person he claimed to be," end quote. One side note about Laura Cottrell is one of the first times she met with the real Lee Harvey Oswald, she had administered a general aptitude test battery to Oswald. Cottrell reported that whereas Oswald had scored well in the parts of the test battery dealing with intelligence, Oswald had received a poor, below-average score in the physical motor coordination part of the test. In the course of discussing the test result with Oswald, Oswald had told Cottrell directly that he was a poor shot with a rifle and he knew it. Dial Ryder worked at the Irving, Texas Sports Shop and stated that he possessed a record of Lee Harvey Oswald's name from early November 1963, just a few weeks before the assassination. Ryder showed agents of the FBI on November 25, 1963, a tag which he claimed was in Oswald's handwriting. The undated tag with the name Oswald attested that three holes had been drilled in an unspecified kind of rifle. Neither Dial or his employer, Charles Greener, believed that they had worked on the gun. Dial told author Leo Savage the rifle Oswald ordered from Chicago, Illinois, came equipped with a telescopic sight. He elaborated, saying that the rifle with the undated tag must have been another weapon than the one Oswald received by mail in March 1963. Dial stated either it was another rifle or another Oswald. Ryder believed that a close inspection of the 6.5mm Mamluk Arcano owned by Oswald would reveal that neither he or his shop worked on the gun. So who was this that brought his rifle into the sports shop if it wasn't the real Lee Harvey Oswald? And why did they use Oswald's name? The narrative continues to be established. Edith Whitworth, owner of the Furniture Mart in Irving, Texas, and another woman visiting in the store at the time, Gertrude Hunter, told of a visit to the Furniture Mart sometime in early November 1963 of a man, a woman, a small girl, and a newborn baby carried by the woman. After the assassination, these women told of this and identified the family as Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald and their two children, a two-year-old girl and a baby girl born October 20, 1963. After dropping a two and parking in the front of the store, a man had entered the store asking for a gunsmith, which a sign outside advertised, while a woman and children waited in the car. Store owner Mrs. Whitworth explained that the gunsmith had moved and referred the man to Irving Sports Shop, located about a block and a half down the street. About to leave, the man noticed and expressed interest in Mrs. Whitworth's furniture for sale, saying he and his wife would be needing some furniture soon, in the next 2 to 3 weeks for an apartment move. The man went out to the car and came back in the store, followed by a sullen, non-speaking woman carrying a newborn baby and with a 2 to 3 year old girl who was whining a little. Mrs. Whitworth began showing the furniture. The man was polite and interested, but the woman showed no interest and said nothing. The man told Mrs. Whitworth either that the baby was a girl and had been born about 2 months prior to the incident at the Furniture Mart or on October 20th. It happens that Marina Oswald gave birth to Rachel, second child of Lee and Marina, on October 20, 1963. The small girl of the family in the Furniture Mart corresponds to then 2-year-old June, daughter of Lee and Marina. Mrs. Whitworth and Mrs. Hunter's other details of the man and woman match Lee and Marina in physical descriptions and in what both Furniture Mart women remembered as the unusual behavior of the woman not speaking. In a face-to-face meeting of the two women with Marina set up by the Warren Commission in July 1964, Mrs. Whitworth and Mrs. Hunter each unequivocally confirmed positive identifications of Marina as the woman who had been in the store while Marina denied it. Another problem is that the family arrived in a car driven by a man with no other driver or person with them. The man had parked the car in front of the store, and the man drove the family away in the car when they left. But Lee Harvey Oswald did not have a car, did not have a driver's license, and both Ruth Payne and Marina testified that they had never seen or known Lee to drive a car on his own. Second, in the face-to-face of Mrs. Whitworth and Mrs. Hunter and Marina set up by the Warren Commission, Marina denied having been in the Furniture Mart. Marina insisted that she had no memory of seeing either woman before, in stark contrast to the two women who positively identified Marina as the woman in the store that day. Ruth Payne, whose detailed testimony to the Warren Commission provided a timeline relied upon for reconstructing the movements and locations of Lee and Marina in October and November 1963. Payne denied knowledge of any trip to the Furniture Mart on the part of either Lee or Marina. She said she would have known if there had been such a trip, and believed such a trip never occurred. Also, according to Mrs. Whitworth and Mrs. Hunter, the family came in the Furniture Mart during business hours on a weekday, remembered by Mrs. Hunter to be Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday of the week ending November 9th or November 16th, and by Mrs. Whitworth, similarly, as one of the weekdays in the week ending November 9th, though neither could situate the exact day. But Oswald's weekdays in early November were accounted for by full-time employment at the Texas School Book Depository, and Oswald's work record showed no missed days or missed hours at work. On weekends when Lee was at Ruth Payne's house, Ruth knew where he and Marina were, and they had never gone to the Furniture Mart, let alone driven there in a car which Lee did not have. Albert Guy Bogard was a car salesman at a downtown Lincoln Mercury dealership on Commerce Street in Dallas. On December 9, 1963, he told the FBI that about 1 month earlier, a young man came into the showroom and said he wanted to buy a car. This was Saturday, November 9th, about 3 weeks before the assassination, sometime between 3 and 4 p.m. Bogart introduced himself and asked the man's name two times before he told him it was Lee Oswald. After showing the cars in the showroom, the two men went outside. Bogart said this was when the man gave his name. The man seemed interested in a red Comet hardtop, and when asked if he had a trade-in, the man said no. Bogart asked him about a down payment. The man said he had some money coming in a few weeks and would pay cash for the car. Next, the salesman took a similar car from the lot and asked the man if he would like to drive it. The man said yes. The FBI document describes the trip the two men took to the Stremmons Freeway and opened the car up to speeds of 75 to 85 miles an hour. When they got back to the dealership, Bogart asked the man to fill out some paperwork, but the man said no. He asked two more times for the man's address or phone number, but the man refused. Bogart would then give the man his business card. Bogart then wrote the name Lee Oswald on the back of one of his own cards and put it in his pocket. After the president was assassinated, he mentioned the card to other workers whom said, quote, he ain't a prospect anymore, end quote. He threw the card in the garbage on November 23rd. November 23rd then began the many visits by the FBI in identifying the man as Lee Harvey Oswald. Bogart's story is corroborated by the assistant sales manager who recalled the customer described by Bogart. Another salesman recalls Bogart asked him to assist the customer should he return in Bogart's absence. The salesman recalled having him also written the name Oswald on the card. One of these witnesses quoted the customer as saying, quote, maybe I'm going to have to go back to Russia to buy a car, end quote. If this remark was in fact made, it surely would have remained in the salesman's mind and was intended to. Here's one problem about this encounter. On this day, the real Lee Harvey Oswald was at Ruth Payne's home visiting his wife and two kids. He was not out test driving cars. On Sunday, November 10th, while the real Lee Harvey Oswald was at the Payne's in Irving, an Oswald imposter was again at the Sportsdrome Rifle Range in Dallas, where Garland Slack saw him. 13-year-old Sterling Wood was with his father, Dr. Homer Wood, at the Sportsdrome Shooting Range when they saw a man who they claimed was Oswald. On November 16, 1963, the Saturday before the assassination, Dr. Wood said his son was shooting next to a man with an unusual rifle that shot a, quote, ball of fire. Dr. Wood would then tell his son, quote, watch out for the 105 howitzer, end quote. And his son Sterling said, quote, don't worry, it's only an Italian carbine, end quote. When Dr. Wood saw Oswald on TV after the assassination, he immediately told his wife that Oswald looked just like the man who was shooting next to their son at the range. Dr. Wood said he didn't mention it to his son, but shortly afterwards his son said, quote, Daddy, is that the fellow that was sitting next to me out at the rifle range? End quote. Sterling Wood and his father, Dr. Homer Wood, both testified before the Warren Commission. Sterling identified a photo of Oswald and said that was the same man he saw. Sterling was also shown a photo of the rifle that the Warren Commission says Oswald used to kill President Kennedy. Sterling confirmed that it was the same rifle, but Sterling said that the sight was different than the one he remembered seeing. Here are the problems with these sightings. First, Oswald didn't have a car, so he would have had to get a ride to the shooting range or take a bus. There's no evidence that he was on a bus with a rifle, but there is testimony that this man departed in a car from Sterling Wood. If Oswald left in a car, then who was the person who drove him? Second, the days when Oswald was supposedly seen at the shooting range, we know he was in Irving with Ruth Payne, Maureen, and his children. And one of the Oswald sightings occurred when Oswald was supposed to have been in Mexico City, according to the Warren Report. One little side note about the gun range that I find interesting is that the FBI collected 23 pounds of shells to see if they could find Engle Mammico Carcano ammo, which is a rifle that the Warren Commission says Lee Harvey Oswald used to kill President Kennedy. They did not find one single Carcano shell. Next week on our mini-series, The JFK Assassination Hills to Die On, we take a look at a couple of incredible sightings of Lee Harvey Oswald being once again in two places at the same time. This time, these occurred the week of the assassination, and one of these sightings has never been spoken about. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.